Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we are discussing the effects of the Trump administration shutting down the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. It officially shut down on July 1st. A recent study published in The Lancet found that USAID programs have saved over 90 million lives over the past two decades. Researchers say if the current cuts continue through the year 2030, 14 million people could lose their lives. Advocates around the world say the cuts have already resulted in preventable deaths, sexual violence, and human trafficking. Joining us are two reporters who've been covering the cuts. Anna Barry Jester is a reporter with ProPublica covering global and public health. In May, she and her colleague Brett Murphy wrote a piece called Death, Sexual Violence, and Human Trafficking: Fallout from U.S. Aid Withdrawal Hits the World's Most Fragile Locations. Hi, Anna. Thanks for your reporting, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. We're also joined by Catherine Harold, East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for the Washington Post. She and her colleague, Hafiz Haroun, wrote a piece called In Sudan, Where Children Clung to Life. Doctors say USAID cuts have been fatal. Hi, Catherine. Thank you for your work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the stories you both tell are devastating, and I just have a basic question. USAID officially shut down on July 1st. Catherine, what does that mean exactly?
It just means that the world is going to be a lot hungrier. People will have less access to medicine, to shelter, that things like HIV prevention have been dramatically cut. So it means a world that's a lot more unstable, in my opinion.
And so these funds are no longer going to countries like Kenya, Sudan, Malawi. It's all stopped?
So there's some funds that are still going on. Some things like WFP, for example, is still receiving in-kind food for Sudan, which is really important. But what stopped was funding for community soup kitchens that were in the most dangerous and hard to reach places. And those were often providing people the single meal that they had in a day.
Mm. Anna, what would you add? How should we wrap our heads around this? Just thinking about what it means for USAID to officially shut down on July 1st.
This is a department and agency in the U.S. government that's been around for decades and provided aid all over the world. You know, when there's a natural disaster or a conflict and we want to provide food or support or tents or housing, any of these things, like, this is the agency that responds. So for the last several months, it's been dismantled. You know, they cut 80% of the programs. The Trump administration cut 80% of the programs that the agency funded. And then on July 1st, the agency ceased to exist entirely. Some of those remaining programs have been moved under the State Department, but it's not clear at all what the plan is for them going forward, what our relationship will be to the world in terms of USAID. And as Catherine said, I mean, there's just massive cuts to major programs we ran, you know, feeding people all over the world in particular, but also all kinds of healthcare, responding to disease outbreaks. All of that work is in either cut or in limbo.
And Anna, based on the reporting that you've done, what do you think people in the United States do not know about USAID and the work that's done around the world?
Yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions. There's a lot of polling about this. People, first of all, people think we spend a huge amount of money on foreign aid. And we do in terms of dollars. The U.S. is by far the biggest donor of international aid of any country. But it was a tiny share of our, you know, of our economy. It was like less than 0.5% of what we spend every year. So we were doing a huge amount of work, but it is a relatively small amount of money that was being spent. And that money went to all sorts of things. I mean, one of the biggest things was giving food to people over the world. Some of that food is grown by U.S. farmers. Some of it was cash assistance, but we were paying for HIV medicines for people all over the world, malaria treatments, you know, helping people in areas riddled with conflict, and really trying to create stability in places where otherwise people were quite desperate.
Catherine, what would you add? What do you think people in the U.S. might not know about the work USAID did around the world?
I think very few people know what it's like to be facing a situation where there's literally nothing you can do personally to save the lives of your children, and to be completely dependent on aid coming from another country. Much of this aid was going to places where people were at war, where people are extremely, extremely poor. And it, you know, I've seen lives saved again and again by this aid. And on my recent trip to Sudan, I saw what happened when that aid was cut off overnight with no warning, which is just that children started to die immediately. Because there was no safety net at all. There was no other alternative. There was nothing for them to fall back on. It's fine to say their government should be taking care of them, but you know, Sudan is in the middle of a massive war, and this was literally the last thing that people had to fall back on to survive. And as soon as it stopped with no warning at all, they died. Their children died. I met one woman who lost two children within a couple of weeks of each other.
Oh, it's just devastating. You begin your piece and you reported from, is it Kwaz Nafisa in Sudan?
Yes.
So you begin your piece by focusing on a three-year-old boy who darted among the mourners, his giggles rising above the soft cadence of condolences. Women with somber faces and bright scarves hugged his weeping mom, patting her shoulders as she stooped to pick up her remaining son. Marwan did not yet know that his twin brother died. And doctors told you that Amran should not have died. The physician at his clinic outside the Sudanese capital said basic antibiotics probably would have cured his chest infection. You go on to write that the International Rescue Committee, which received a large amount of its funding from the United States, had been scheduled to deliver the medicines in February. Then the new U.S. administration froze foreign aid programs and a stop work order came down from Washington. Amran died at the end of May. So these cuts happened so fast. Can you tell us more about this family?
Yeah, I mean, we bumped into them completely by accident. We were going to go and visit this doctor because we knew that the clinic had been due to receive this help, which was just suddenly stopped. And as we were talking to her, and I asked her, how many people would you say have died as a result of this aid that you were due to receive not coming? She said, oh, probably like at least around 8. She said, one of them died yesterday. Actually, they're having his funeral just, you know, next door. You could go and stop in on your way back. And we did. And it was extremely poignant to me because these two boys were identical twins. And so you could see the ghost of the boy who had died in his living brother. And this little boy running around being so happy and not really knowing what was going on, but just a lot of people were coming to his mom's house. And his mom couldn't bear to tell him that his brother was dead. Because they'd been so close. So she was just telling him that he's in the hospital. He'll come back, you know.
Oh, it's devastating. And going back to what people in the U.S. might not realize, Catherine, you write, disease and famine are spreading unchecked in Sudan. More than half the population, some 30 million people, need aid. More than 12 million have fled their homes. And for so many families barely hanging on, programs funded by USAID were a lifeline, providing food to the hungry and medical care for the sick. And I've been thinking about this a lot because, you know, U.S. foreign policy just results in so much death and destruction around the world. I mean, look at the Middle East. It's just devastating. So a lot of people tend to write off agencies like USAID just because of the wars that the United States have started, the money that's spent on military. These programs, like you write, are a lifeline.
Yes, and I've been reporting on war and famine for more than 20 years. And I have interviewed people. It's something that greatly interests me is how can we best help people? If we start from the idea that we have a little bit of money, this 0.5%. We can have a huge impact, saving millions of lives with that money. What's the best way to do it? So I reported from the famine in Somalia in 2011 when 260,000 people starved to death. And I reported again in 2017 where the rains actually were worse, but because of a shift in the way that aid was delivered, and because there was greater access, that Al-Shabaab didn't block people from moving to get aid, the fatalities plummeted. And I interviewed, for example, a woman who lost a child in 2011. She had to leave him by the side of the road because he was too weak to walk. And she had to bring her children to the place where there was food being given out. And then they had switched the way that aid was delivered in 2017, moved towards cash, which allows people to stay in their villages, bolsters local markets, puts money into the local economy, is, I think, like 13 times more efficient than giving out food aid. And she didn't lose any children that time. So I've been interested for a long time in the effect that aid has, how efficient it can be. There's a lot of efficiencies that could be made in this system. But a lot of the inefficiencies that were in the system were put that way because Congress wanted like extremely stringent reporting rules. U.S. farmers wanted to be able to have a market for their product, which could be bought by the U.S. government. So a lot of the inefficiencies that people criticize in the system were actually put there by U.S. lawmakers. Mm.
And also, as you report, some soup kitchens were funded by the United States and they were forced to close. Moms told you that their babies, I mean, this is just so hard to even read. Moms told you their babies starved quietly while older siblings died begging for food?
Yes, that was one particular woman that we interviewed. And, you know, there was this neighborhood was so poor. They're just living in kind of houses, adobe houses. Hundreds of the houses had been burned by the armed group fighting the military. Nobody has any food at all. So these soup kitchens were the one thing keeping people alive, where they made food in big pots. And then people could, maybe not every person could get a meal each day, but a family might get two meals to share between seven people. It's just enough to keep people alive. They were starving, but they were starving slowly. Mm. And so when that food stopped, the children just started to die immediately. They didn't have any fats. They didn't have any reserves. You know, their bodies were already shutting down.
And Anna, you and your colleague Brett Murphy got your hands on exclusive State Department records showing what has happened as a result of these cuts. And you found that South Sudanese refugees in Ethiopia have begged a visiting government delegation from the United States not to cut food rations any further. This is according to a cable documenting the visit. Aid workers in another group of camps reported that they expect to run out of funding at the end of May for a program that fights malnutrition for 8,600 pregnant and nursing moms. Can you tell us more about how you got these State Department records?
Yeah, I mean, so Catherine's been doing incredible work documenting, you know, what happened in Sudan when the aid was cut. And what's sort of significant about these documents we got is this is internal communications that we obtained, where diplomats abroad, you know, U.S. Employees who are writing back to D.C. to tell them what's happening in other parts of the world, went from warning that cutting USAID would harm people to documenting all sorts of issues that they were seeing in their countries as a result of the cuts of aid. So, you know, warnings that cutting food aid to large refugee camps would cause instability and harm people when, you know, that transformed into documenting in Malawi an increase in human trafficking and sexual violence among refugee camps. And I mean, one of the important things here is that, you know, people have the internet all over the world, and they are aware that the U.S. is cutting aid. They know that the World Food Program is saying they're going to have to cut the calories that they get each month even further, from, you know, the 2100 bare minimum calories from somebody's supposed to have to 400 calories. They read this news. And so even just the warnings that those cuts are coming causes instability in the camps. And these documents showed that US officials were letting Washington, DC know that was happening, that this was causing violence and instability in places all over the world as a result of our cuts.
You interviewed Eric Schwartz, a former State Department Assistant Secretary and member of the National Security Council during Democratic administrations, and he said, "I struggle for adjectives to adequately describe the horror that this administration has visited on the world. It keeps me up at night." And then you also reached out to the State Department under Trump. In response to a detailed list of questions, a State Department spokesperson said, "It is grossly misleading to blame unrest and violence around the world on America. No one can expect the U.S. to be equipped to feed every person on Earth or be responsible for providing medication for every living human." What else did this spokesperson say?
That is pretty much the extent of the response to our questions. You know, we want everybody to know what we're writing about and have a chance to respond. But this is what they told us, that the U.S. can't be responsible for the entire world. I mean, one thing we've heard repeatedly from experts is there are, as Catherine said, there are many criticisms to be made of how aid is delivered, lots of really important conversations to have about the best way to help people who are in desperate situations, to help people in the middle of conflict zones. But the thing we've heard over and over again is that pulling that aid overnight without any ability to plan, and particularly in countries where the governments are much poorer than the United States, they may have already made their budgets for the year, and they may simply just not have the capacity to help people. Or there are minority populations that they may be less, inspired to help, things like that. That doing that overnight is a death sentence.
Today, we are talking about the effects of the Trump administration shutting down USAID. It officially happened on July 1st, but cuts have been happening over the past several months. And today's guests have found that these cuts have resulted in preventable deaths, sexual violence, human trafficking. A new study was just published in The Lancet. It found that USAID programs have saved over 90 million lives over the past two decades. If current cuts continue through the year 2030, 14 million people could lose their lives. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you've been following this story, if you have any connections to USAID, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Anna Barry Jester is reporter with ProPublica. She recently wrote a piece called "Death, Sexual Violence, and Human Trafficking: Fallout from USAID Withdrawal Hits the World's Most Fragile Locations." Catherine Howrold is East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Her recent piece is called "In Sudan, Where Children Clung to Life, Doctors Say USAID Cuts Have Been Fatal." Catherine, what did you hear from doctors and advocates in Sudan about what's next? How are they going to deal with these cuts?
Well, they're doing the best they can. They're trying to raise money from the diaspora. Of course, when the war broke out, many Sudanese had to flee with whatever they could carry in a backpack. The banks were looted. People lost their life savings. Homes were burned. I'm very good friends with a woman who's a prominent doctor and used to run the emergency department at the biggest hospital in Khartoum. I met her in a refugee camp in northern Ethiopia, where she was delivering babies with the light of a phone and a razor blade. She's completely penniless. And many people, unfortunately, are in the same situation. So these are the people, in many cases, that folks are trying to raise funds for. They are trying to appeal to other countries to help them. And in a lot of cases, they're just having to shut down programs. The soup kitchen that I went to that had shut down for 5 months The WFP had just stepped in to support them, which is great. But a lot of things just unfortunately shut down and people die. People forget that sometimes there is no alternative.
And then what did you hear specifically from doctors? You have this incredible quote from a physician, Amira El Sadig. This is at the health center in Amran's village of Quaz Nafisa, which is 35 miles north of Khartoum. It's supposed to serve 60,000 people, but its entire stock of medicines now fits on a single shelf of a filing cabinet. And Amira El Sadig is 41. You write, she was delighted last year when the International Rescue Committee said it would provide the clinic with medications, solar panels to cool vaccines, oxygen tanks, simple medical devices, and lab tests for malaria and other diseases. When Trump took office, he signed an executive order calling for an immediate freeze to foreign aid programs. In February, Musk said that Doge was feeding USAID into the wood chipper, and then sweeping cuts followed. And then, included in Sudan, staffers were fired, payment systems were disabled. And so this is what's so devastating. Sadig listed a handful of what she said were preventable deaths between February, when the meds were supposed to arrive, and the end of May. So many people had these very preventable issues and deaths. She said there are deaths in the villages around here we don't even know about. Sadig wishes she could solve the problem with her own hands, that her country could stand on its own. And she said, we say thank you to the American people for helping with our suffering.
Yeah, you know, people are not angry with America. They're grateful that America helped. And they recognize that America has the right to use its resources as it sees fit. They are hopeful without feeling entitled that maybe someday there will be some help. But most of the people who were receiving this aid have been shown time and again that you can't expect anything out of life, that anything that comes is a bonus and something to be grateful for and something to be shared in your community. I can't count the number of times I've seen, you know, a group of refugees cut up one apple to share between them, or, you know, divide one meal meant for one person, or older children stand back to let younger children eat first. You know, it's very, people only survive in situations like this if they're part of a community, and being part of a community means sharing what little you have.
What will it take? I mean, we were talking about the Medicaid cuts that are coming after the midterms here in the United States, Catherine. When you talk to officials about what it will take to bring these programs back, I mean, let's say a Democrat wins in 4 years. How long would it take to build back some of these programs? I mean, this is just unprecedented.
I think some of the harm that's going to come is going to be permanent. So, for example, earlier in the year, I spent some time with some Kenyan sex workers who had previously been doing outreach on HIV programs. They'd each got $100 a month, which was just enough to keep food on the table and pay the rent in a shack in, you know, one of the low-income neighborhoods. That had vanished. They were all, like 10 of them, outside a nightclub. These are women my age in their 40s, you know, with some of them like 8 kids to look after, some of their own, some belonging to colleagues that had got murdered, some belonging to a sister that went missing, trying to find a client. Nobody had money for condoms. They used to have free condoms. Condoms prevent HIV infection. A condom costs about 2 cents if you buy it in bulk, which USAID was doing. Having somebody on ARVs for the rest of their life, which the US is continuing to fund, is about 15 cents a day, I think. So none of these women who are HIV positive sex workers can now spend money on condoms, because that means taking the food out of their children's mouths. So we are going to see a huge spike in infections. Mm.
Al Jazeera has a piece just today, actually. U.S. aid cuts could lead to millions more HIV/AIDS deaths by 2029, the UN warns. Unless funding is replaced, the halt to foreign aid by the administration of Donald Trump could reverse decades of progress on HIV. Catherine, what are you hearing from other funders around the globe? Is there any way to fill the gap that has been caused by the Trump administration?
I mean, the U.S. was the biggest donor by far, hands down. It wasn't the biggest donor per capita. There's quite a number of countries, including the United Kingdom, Germany, Iceland, quite a lot of European countries that were ahead per capita. But just the sheer size of the U.S. means nobody can fill that hole. Russia doesn't do humanitarian aid. China does, you know, commercial loans. The many European countries have cut back on aid now to boost their defense budgets. So no, nobody can fill that hole.
Anna, what are your thoughts on that? We have an email from someone who says, are other countries going to get together to try to fund this gap? What would you add?
Yeah, no one can fill the hole of the U.S. And what's more is the U.S. is asking Europe to spend more money on defense. And so as a result, there was kind of a cascade effect where other countries also reduced the aid that they were providing, right? Because the U.S. is reducing not only its humanitarian aid, but also its military support in other parts of the world. So yeah, there's not really anyone who can fill this gap. And I mean, the other thing is, to the point that we're reporting on the harm that's happening right now, but everyone says a lot of the biggest harm is yet to come. So, you know, you have places where they've stocked out now of tuberculosis medicines. I've talked to physicians who are saying, well, we had a clinic here, we were testing people for TB, we had lots of TB in this area, and now we're not even testing. And so, you know, it takes a couple of years before those are people who then are not getting treated. They're passing it around in the community. There's more infection and more death. But that is planning. That's everyone expects that in the future.
You know, it's surprising, Anna, to hear that no one could fill this gap. Because does this number sound right to you? The BBC reports that the U.S. aid foreign budget totaled about $68 billion in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So $68 billion is not a lot of money when you look at weapons budgets from other countries or other budgets from other countries. Why is it so hard to fill this gap, at least in the near term?
Yeah, it's so much and also so little. I mean, this has been part of a philosophy of the U.S. that the idea is that our humanitarian aid went hand in hand with all of our other foreign aid work. And so this was how we built relationships with other countries. This is how we supported people. Generals love to say that if we provide more humanitarian aid, we have to buy fewer bullets. But, you know, this has been part of the U.S. philosophy. And as Catherine said, some of the other, you know, largest economies in the world do not do this. They do not provide humanitarian aid at this scale. So not only is the largesse of the U.S. and our economy and our place in the world hard to fill, it's also we were leading the charge, if you will, on an approach that said we should take care of people who are in conflict, that you should provide food. And of course, there's all kinds of problems with the way that, you know, aid has been delivered and the U.S.'s approach to the world. I don't mean to oversimplify, but it is just an amount of money that no other nation has been able to provide. Yeah.
And just for some context, so the United States is spending about $68 billion in aid every year. And as we just reported a few days ago, Trump got $170 billion to militarize the border and to just, you know, hire more ICE agents, build more beds, $170 billion for ICE, and then USAID or aid overall, $68 billion a year, just for some comparisons. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we are talking about the consequences of the Trump administration shutting down USAID. Today's reporters have been writing about these cuts, they have found that they've already resulted in preventable deaths, sexual violence, and human trafficking. Anna Barry Jester is a reporter with ProPublica. Catherine Harold is East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's Media Roundtable, we'll discuss Democracy Noir, a documentary that explores dissent against Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his far-right party. We'll also discuss Paramount's $16 million lawsuit settlement with Donald Trump over a 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris. And then speaking of cuts, next Tuesday, we'll be speaking with doctors about the Republican Party's unprecedented cuts to Medicaid. Wednesday, we'll check in with food banks to find out how they're preparing for massive cuts to food assistance in the U.S. Today, we are talking about USAID shutting down on July 1st and what this has already meant for so many people around the globe. The cuts have resulted in preventable deaths, sexual violence, and human trafficking. Anna Barry Jester is a reporter with ProPublica. She recently wrote a piece called Death, Sexual Violence, and Human Trafficking: Fallout from U.S. Aid Withdrawal Hits the World's Most Fragile Locations. Catherine Harold is East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. She recently wrote a piece called In Sudan, Where Children Clung to Life. Doctors say USAID cuts have been fatal. A listener called in to say, what is the logic of cutting off USAID? Simply put, racism. And let's hear from a caller in San Francisco, Adriana. Hi, Adriana. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose. This is Adriana Camarena. I'm resident in San Francisco, but I'm from Mexico, and I have been a USAID consultant, or was, for over a decade. And so I just want to tell you about the programs I worked on, and they had to do with rule of law and governance. I worked in Mexico, in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Peru, in so many places where I was the one who would go into the field to try to develop the proposals. And then it was the company specializing in managing USAID projects who would bid on these projects. I worked on some of my favorite projects. One was to protect human rights defenders and journalists in Mexico. Another one was to strengthen the criminal justice system in Mexico at a time of deep reform. I worked on transparency and accountability projects in El Salvador. And one of the last trips I took, it was not a successful bid that we had, but it was fascinating for me, was to Kyrgyzstan to look at how we could support civil society at a time of closing civic space. And those are the projects that I worked on. And it was just some of the loveliest people I would meet. And I also want to make sure that people understand that while you did have people specializing in the bureaucracy of USAID, managing these projects, the people who ran these projects were local people, specialists, experts, and they were leaders in their countries trying to make these areas of democracy more functional and sustainable.
Gosh, I'm so sorry. What are your thoughts about what's going to happen to these programs now?
Well, I think some of them will be picked up by the State Department or INL, depending on what areas are being supported. But otherwise, my hope is that those people in Mexico or Guatemala or Salvador or Peru who are working locally on these issues have some, will depend on their creativity. Obviously, without the backing of USAID and the U.S. government, that provided some leverage to people pushing the boundaries around these around democratic issues in their countries. So it will be more dangerous for many of them. Some of them may have to find other work options. But my hope is that locally there was enough there has always been enough talent to make, to find some creative outlet, but there won't be money, or there will be. That's the problem, you know?
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in and sharing this story. And this raises another question, Catherine, about the incredible people who work on the ground and are involved in these programs. I mean, you have so many examples in your story. You write about an Al-Manar feeding center in Sudan. Al-Manar director Amna Cornulis says that deaths have skyrocketed since the soup kitchens closed. Many children died at home, she said. Families stopped coming when the center ran out of aid to distribute. She asked the U.S. to continue its support. She said, all we need is a little and we will share together. So what happens to people like the director Amna Cornulis and all of the other doctors and advocates that you interviewed?
I mean, there's so many people out there doing incredible things. It's a complete fallacy and a deep insult to pretend that people are like sitting back on their haunches just waiting for aid. People are out there. They're risking their lives. They're often getting killed. They are getting arrested. They're getting tortured to try to get aid to people. The Sudan has this incredible network of civilian-run what are called emergency response rooms that are often run by pro-democracy activists who helped bring down the regime of Omar al-Bashir. And they smuggled food and medicine across the front lines. I've interviewed people that have been, detained by either the military or the paramilitary. I've interviewed people who've had friends who were killed or tortured to death. One of the guys I met had been arrested more than 40 times. One of his arms was partly paralyzed because he'd been shot. The other one had chemical burns on it from these this very intense sort of tear gas that they used to break up demonstrations. And this guy, his wife had been detained many times. He was getting up at 5 a.m. every morning to cycle through the neighborhood and give out chlorine tablets to people like tea ladies, municipal wells, this kind of stuff to try to stop cholera, which is a disease that can kill you within hours from dirty water. And this guy, he doesn't give up. He's not getting any funding from USAID, but he's just getting up there every morning. He and his team of volunteers, he's been doing it for years. He's going to keep on doing it. And he says, you know what? And if the war finishes and we don't have democracy, we'll go back to the streets. Mm. I'm ready to fight for my country.
Oh, this is amazing. So this is Momen, a dreadlocked 33-year-old. He was arrested more than 40 times?
Yes.
During the 2019 uprising?
And in the years leading up to that. So he'd been an activist for about 5 years. Yes, during that uprising, after that uprising, when the military and paramilitary seized power again, and he even got arrested after the war began. But by then, he'd helped so many people. There was such a public outcry that after he was beaten up in prison, they actually took him out of the prison, stuck him in a police cell for a little bit, and fed him some milk and some meat and wouldn't release him for a couple of days till his bruises had gone down and said, make a statement, tell the people that we're treating you well. And he's like, I'm not going to do it until you let me go.
Wow. And again, this is Momen. He's in Sudan. He said, our country needs us. We are going to change Sudan. Catherine, I have to ask you, I mean, thank you for the reporting you do. It's hard to read this. What is it like for you to be interviewing people and seeing this with your own eyes? I mean, it must be so hard, but just it must be so amazing to be able to elevate these voices and bring these stories to the readers of the Washington Post.
I'm inspired every time I meet somebody like that. And that's the best part of this job, is that I frequently meet refugee leaders, the leader of a sex workers union, doctors, civilian volunteers, pro-democracy activists, people that have so little. I have more in my bedroom closet than many of them might own. And yet what they do is they dedicate their lives to helping others. And I'm constantly inspired by that.
And again, it's so important, Anna, to focus on the people who are doing such important work. You all spoke with the World Food Program's Kenya Country Director, Lauren Landis, and the World Food Program will cut its rations down to 28%. This was back in June, so maybe it's even lower now. Can you just talk about the importance of elevating these voices? Because Lauren Landis said, we are living off the fumes of what was delivered in late 2024 or early 2025 on a recent visit to a facility treating malnourished children younger than five. She said she saw kids who were walking skeletons like I have not seen in a decade. And so you write the story, we do a show on it. And right now, I just have to wonder, how is Lauren Landis today? What is she, what can she do from here on out?
I mean, this is such an important point. Like, for, you know, we see USAID and this money goes to these very large international NGOs, but so much of the work is done by people who are from the communities or live in the communities. They're not doing it just for a paycheck. They really care. So, you know, we've talked to people who were running clinics that were funded by USAID. The funding got cut and they're just doing the work as volunteers now, because that's what they care about. They care about taking care of their communities. When I was talking to Lauren Landis, you know, she's a country director. She's responsible for everyone who's doing the work trying to deliver food aid in Kenya. And she said, you know, I have to think about the security of my employees. So when they cut rations and people get desperate, and hunger, you know, causes people to get desperate. Imagine if you couldn't feed your children, what you wouldn't do to give them a meal, right? Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, if we cut it so much, at some point it becomes impossible for us to do the work, because it's just not safe to have my employees out there delivering food, because people will do things when they're desperate. So I think it's both incredibly inspiring how many people you get to talk to and do this work, because they just really care about the people in their community, and they're going to find a way to do it to the best of their ability, regardless of US funding. But we also create dangerous situations for people who are doing the work when we pull away the aid in this way.
Right. And according to a previously unreported cable from the State Department that you got your hands on from early May, news of funding cuts to refugee camps' food programs in Kenya led to a violent demonstration. During one protest, police responded with gunfire and wounded four people. Refugees have also died at food distribution centers, the officials wrote in the cable, including a pregnant woman who died under a stampede. Aid workers said they expected more people to get hurt as, quote, vulnerable households become increasingly desperate. So, I mean, the reverberations of this are hitting so many people.
Yeah, I was talking with several refugees in Zaleka, which is a massive refugee camp in Malawi. And they said, you know, look, we started having a ton of instability, increases in crime, and a lot of problems just when the word spread that the World Food Program was going to have to cut rations and that the UN was backing out from the camp, all due to US cuts. And I talked to them recently, and the World Food Program was able to secure funding for a couple more months just to keep even, it's not the full rations that people are receiving, but some rations. And she said already that's changed the way people are living in the camp. There's just a little bit less crime, a little bit less sort of aggression that they're feeling there. It makes a really big deal to know that there's sort of food and aid on the way. But, you know, Catherine made this point earlier. No one expects the U.S. to provide this aid. No one expects the U.S. to provide food. They're very grateful for it. But when you pull it away like this so quickly, it does harm people, both in sort of the immediate, like they have needs, they need food, but also it is really detrimental to the environments that they're living in, right? Where people are aware that they might not have food next month, and you have to start thinking about what you're going to do.
Right. And to your point, to provide some context, you write, despite being one of the poorest countries in the world, Malawi has been a relative beacon of stability in a region that has seen numerous civil wars and unrest in recent decades. In early March, officials there warned Washington counterparts that cuts to the more than $300 million USAID plan to provide the country in aid a year would dramatically increase the effects of the worsening economy already in motion.
Right. I mean, that's actually, it's a sort of a less understood, but, you know, we're also harming economies, right? There's a lot of job loss that comes from these aid cuts. And so there's that. But also, the U.S. has sort of had this role of helping countries like Malawi, which is extremely poor, but hosts a lot of refugees from surrounding countries that have been experiencing civil war. And so the U.S. has provided aid that helps not only the refugees who are there, but it helps keep Malawi as a stable country. It helps prevent war. It helps prevent the local community, who is also hungry and also has needs that the government has not been able to provide. It helps keep some, you know, peace between these sort of very large refugee communities and what they call the host communities, you know, the people who are in the country. And people say that's just an incredibly important role in itself, helping to maintain stability in the few places where, you know, in these places where there's not a civil war.
We have a couple of comments from listeners. Stephen writes, when will the bubonic plague and HIV reach America? Foreign aid helps America. When preventable deaths are not treated and people start dying in America, it will be Donald Trump who is responsible. How many people in the U.S. died from COVID because of Trump's incompetence? News organizations have to connect the dots. People who vote for Trump have to realize they're voting against their best interest and health. And Leslie writes in, where are the voices of Christian groups who have supported Trump and also supported international aid to children in the poorest countries? Catherine, are you hearing from any Christian groups that say they want to fill some of these gaps?
So, some Christian groups have been speaking out about this, but no group has the power and the clout and the funding of the U.S. government. It's a complete fallacy to say anybody can step into this hole that's been left. Groups are speaking out, some aren't.
Some are and some are not. What would you add, Anna? Anything to add?
Yeah, just that there also has been, you know, a lot of effort over the years to do things like coordinate aid so that, you know, you don't just have small groups doing little bits here and there, but rather you're kind of looking at what the needs are across an entire community or across an entire refugee population and figuring out how to use the aid in the most effective way. So not only, yeah, there's the largesse of the U.S., the amount of money it was spending, no one can fill that, but it's also, I think a lot of people would argue that it's not a great way to deliver aid by having, you know, individual small groups out there doing work without coordinating amongst each other.
Another listener wonders if you have any thoughts on Trump meeting with the presidents of West African countries just yesterday. This is a 3-day summit. Trump has been saying trade, not aid. Catherine, have you been following this at all?
Lost you.
Oh, Catherine, have you been following this?
Sorry, I lost you there.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, a listener wondered if you had any thoughts on Trump meeting with the presidents of West African countries this week. He's been saying trade, not aid. Have you been following that?
Trade is great. Yeah, trade is great. And that is always a, you know, fantastic thing to do if the capacity for that exists. You know, a lot of these are countries that don't have a lot of trade with the U.S., perhaps because of governance issues. Mm-hmm. If your electricity supply is not working, it's hard to run manufacturing, for example. If your roads are in a terrible state, your farmers are not going to be able to get their produce to market. So I think we have to be really clear that there's a huge difference between humanitarian aid, which is people will die without it, development aid, which is supposed to make countries reach a level where they can start to trade and then trade. So these are three different things. It's not that you can substitute one for the other.
In our remaining minutes, Catherine, what are your plans to continue reporting on these devastating cuts and how they're affecting people around the globe?
Well, we are potentially looking at going to Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where many of your listeners might know there's a huge epidemic of sexual violence by a plethora of armed groups out there. And one of the medics emailed me a couple of days ago and said they'd had a 14-year-old girl show up who had been gang raped and walked through the bush for 2 days. And they didn't have any rape kits to give her. She'd walked all that way bleeding, looking for help, and there was nothing to help her. And about 30% of the clinics in that area have run out of rape kits. That means women are not able to get medication to stop them from getting HIV. They're not able to get medication to stop them from getting pregnant. They may suffer other medical complications. So unfortunately, I think we have not even begun yet to see the effects of these cuts.
Oh, that's just so devastating. You know, I have to ask you, Catherine, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this. You know that a lot of people are angry about Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post. And I always tell people when they say they're going to cancel their subscription or they just blanketly say in a blanket statement, I'm not going to read the Post because of this. I mean, you work for the Washington Post. This reporting is so critical. And you're doing this because, I mean, the Post is funding your reporting.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you want to read the stories, read the stories. But if you don't want to read the stories in the Post, there's plenty of other great stories out there from the New York Times, from ProPublica, from The Economist, from The Wall Street Journal. We are not the only people that are reporting these stories. You can see them anywhere you want. All you have to do is open Google.
Right. Well, I appreciate the answer, but your piece is so important. And just thank you so much for the important reporting that you have done and will continue to do. Anna, in about 30 seconds, what are you and your colleagues at ProPublica planning to do to continue covering this story?
Yeah, we're planning to travel and see what the consequences of the USAID cuts have been. But, you know, like we've been saying, so much of this is going to take time to play out. And that's one of the great things about ProPublica. We plan to stay on this and follow what's happening in the months and years ahead, not just in this sort of immediate aftermath.
Anna Berry Jester is a reporter with ProPublica covering global and public health. Catherine Howrold is East and Southern Africa Bureau Chief for the Washington Post, and I hope you can read their stories and share them. Find them at KALW.org, click news, and then your call. Catherine and Anna, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.